This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with it. Since you wasn't a part of the judgment, my own sweet time didn't change what I found. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast of my show, Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Shane Told. It is a beautiful, sunny day here in Canada. The snow has melted. It's March. I'm just loving it. Things are great. Things are amazing. I hope you're doing very well on this fine Tuesday morning or whenever you're listening to this. Could be years from now. Who even knows? But hey, we have an awesome episode today with a guy I have had quite a level of intrigue about for a lot of years, Mr. Ryan Clark of Demon Hunter. He's also an incredible and successful, very successful graphic designer. He's known for what he's doing now with his company Invisible Creatures. I know him best from back in the 2000s being the premier album cover designer, artist for so many bands in the scene. He designed all those iconic album covers, many of which I'm sure you know. Him and his brother were the masterminds behind Asterisk, which was a part of Tooth & Nail Records, designing pretty much everything on that label, but a whole lot more as well. We talk a lot about that. We talk about Demon Hunter and what an enigma they are in a lot of ways. But look, this band is serious. They just put out, last week, two new albums at the same time, War and Peace, those are the names of them. They both charted in the Billboard Top 200, selling more than 25,000 copies between them. This is a band people really care about. So sit back, listen to this. Very informative, very interesting, with a band that is very under the radar in some circles and very not under the radar in others. Before we get into that, hey, thanks for being here. As always, hey, if you want to get in touch, super easy. You can send me an email, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. You can add me on social media at Shane Told or at leadsingersyndrome or at leadsingersyn, S-Y-N, if you want to tweet at me. I also have to give a big shout out to all the members of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. My sinners, where you at? I know I'm going to see you at Sinnerfest. Things are awesome right now with the club. If you don't know about the club, basically what it is if the one episode a week isn't enough for you, we have an option. We have more bonus contents. We have merchandise. We have an amazing community of like-minded fans. And this thing is growing rapidly. We are well over 300 members now. New members getting added all the time. It is super, super cool. And I really think if you're a fan of the show, you're going to love it. So check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. And it only costs you as little as $6 a month. That gets you in. If you want to pay a little more, you can get even cooler stuff. Hey, this is really what helps me deliver this show to you every single week. So if you make a contribution, it really does help me out. Again, the link, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. In other news with me, my band Silverstein is going on tour this summer. It's announced we're touring with our best friends in the world, August Burns Red. Ugh, the best dudes. Also on the bill is Silent Planet. This tour is going all over the U.S. and Canada, not just Toronto, Montreal, Canada. Like, I'm talking the entire country. So make sure you go pick up tickets. I think AugustBurnsRed.com. I think that has them. Actually, they go on sale on Friday. So pick them up on Friday. But it is a really, really cool tour, a really great announcement. And I'm really excited to be doing some club shows in the summer. That's rare. Typically, when we do club shows and we go to all these cities in the U.S., it's like freezing cold. So I'm very, very excited about that. So yes, on Friday, get your tickets. I want to thank everybody that tuned in last week for my conversation with Cody from Set It Off. That was a great one. If you missed it, go back, listen to it. Go back, listen to the one the week before. Oh wait, there wasn't one. How about the week before that with Lauren Babich? We have some great episodes, like 160 something of them. So go back, check out the back episodes. And if you do enjoy the show, please spread the word, tell a friend, tell a loved one. Let's keep this thing rolling. Also, I want to give a big welcome and a shout out to a new sponsor of the show, merchtable.com. You will be interrupted for a little ad in the middle of this one. Make sure you go check them out as well. Well, anyway, hey, let's get in to a very informative conversation with frontman, designer, and father, Mr. Ryan Clark of Demon Hunter.
Whether I'm the last one alive,
Ryan Clark of Demon Hunter, among other things. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for taking the time. One of the busiest people I think I know of. except that you don't tour that much. So maybe that's true. Maybe that's the secret.
It's part of it, definitely. They're with the amount of things that I've kind of gotten used to juggling. There's definitely no way that I could add touring to that mix, you know, at least not in the capacity where other bands are doing it, you know, like months and months out of the year. I've always managed to kind of like find a balance between a lot of things, but it's mainly because of the way that I can kind of dictate like the schedules of all those things.
No, it's kind of incredible and impressive. And to be honest, I'm a little bit jealous. You know, I'm turning 38 in 2 days, you know, so I know you're a little bit older than me, I think. But, you know, we're kind of in the same, you know, frame of mind, place in our musical careers where, you know, you're about to release album number 9 and album number 10 together on March 1st, which is pretty cool as well. I want to talk a lot about that.
Yeah.
You know, my band, we just released our 8th album a couple years ago. So, you know, my life consists of pretty much touring nonstop. That's right. What I do. Yeah. The people that I talk to on this show, that's what they do. You know, and I guess that I just felt like that was a great narrative, you know, to kind of base part of this interview around. It's amazing not only that you're able to sustain yourself and you do all these other things, but I feel like Demon Hunter is as big as ever.
Yeah, I mean, when we first started, it was kind of I mean, we would talk to a lot of other labels about, you know, potentially signing to them when our deal was up, or, you know, licensing deals for like international release and stuff like that. And the answer was always like, well, like, you know, let us know when you guys start touring or, you know, come back to us when you guys are like an active band. And you know, I think over the years we kind of proved that that wasn't a necessity for us, at least not for the type of thing that we were looking to get out of it. And by we, I mean at the time, my brother and I. We both, you know, both of us were juggling design careers and music careers at the same time, And so we kind of had our cake and got to eat it too. Because it's two passions of ours, you know, and there's something nice about having that, the schedule of something like a normalcy of just, you know, waking up and hitting the computer and having like a normal sort of day and being able to be around your family and all that kind of stuff. And then almost as the touring happens, kind of take that as more of like a break or a vacation or a, you know, a
totally.
Chance to hang out with your friends, you know?
Absolutely. That's right. The grind. I mean, when you guys go on tour and you do, you know, a string of dates or you do festivals, that must be real special. You
it
know
is.
What I mean? Not just for you, but the people that are there, knowing how limited the, you know, those kinds of things are.
It is. And I think that has sustained us like on both sides of the fence. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's made it so that, I mean, especially since three of the members are in Nashville and two are in Seattle, it's like every time we get together, it's fun. It's like exciting. You know, these are some of my best friends, but we don't live in the same place and we don't get to hang out all the time. So when we do, it's sweet. It's like a great, you know, excuse to get together and hang out and catch up. And then on the flip side of the coin, in terms of like the way that it's perceived from other people, there's an exclusivity to it. When we're in Dallas, Texas, for instance, we're probably not going to be there for another 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you know, like, and so there's something about like, get it while the getting's good. Cause you know, never know when we're going to be back or when we're going to be doing it again. We have no plans on stopping, that's for sure. But the frequency of us playing live and, our ability to be able to do that especially for stretches of time, over the years kind of changes. It ebbs and flows a little bit. And I think there will be years where we go out more than we have in the last, you know, I'd say 2 or 3 years, just because a lot of us have been getting used to fatherhood and just like a complete change of dynamic in that regard. But as our kids get a little bit older and things like that, I wouldn't rule out the idea that we would kind of start to, you know, string some dates together and do a little bit more. It's just, it's a total toss up, but, there's something about that model that we started with almost just out of necessity that ended up actually kind of working in our favor.
Yeah. It's really interesting and really unique. And, you know, from my perspective, being, you know, a guy in whatever scene you want to call it, you know, admittedly not the Christian, you know, hardcore scene at all. I didn't even know who you guys were until I think it was either your second or third album came out. Mm-hmm. And it was like, who is this band that charted, you know, at like number whatever, like 19 on the Billboard with 25,000 albums sold? I'm like, what the hell? Like, what? This is on Solid State and I've never even heard of it.
Yeah.
It was crazy how, and ever since that moment, I've always had, you know, an ear to the ground about your band. I've always been very intrigued. And it's just kind of crazy now, you know, this came in like, hey, do you want to talk to Ryan from Demon Hunter? And I'm like, absolutely. You know, like there was, and there's so much other stuff. And I want to like kind of just bring it up here and then talk about it more later. Like the stuff you did with Asterisk with your brother.
Yeah.
I mean, cutting edge back then.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff was amazing too. But before we get into all that, let's go back and talk about, you know, the humble beginnings. You know, I know you're originally from Sacramento, California.
Mm-hmm.
You moved up to Seattle at some point. Your former band, Training for Utopia, that was a band that I was a big fan of too. And it's kind of funny how I got into that. I bought a bunch of records from Tooth and Nail, and they had some kind of package where it was like, for an extra like $10, we'll give you 5 CDs.
Hmm.
You know, which at the time it's like, oh my god, that's the best deal totally. Ever. And they just, you know, threw that CD in the box, and I was like, oh, this like looks cool or whatever. And I wore that thing out. Like I listened to that record so much, and then
that's awesome.
You know, that's back in the day when it was hard to get information about the band, so I didn't even know what it was really. You know what I mean? Other than being a Christian metalcore band from the West Coast,
right?
So I know there's a lot there, but hey, talk to me about that kind of your early life, how you know your upbringing was and stuff, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I was born in Southern California, in Whittier, California, but only lived there for about a year before we moved to Bend, Oregon. My dad moved there for a job pastoring a church. He was a pastor pretty much my whole growing up. And so we lived in Bend, Oregon, kind of before Bend was Bend. Now it's like this big vacation destination. But when we lived there, it was a really small, really small town. We moved from there. It was a great upbringing because it was a lot, you know, we had a little property and creeks and tree houses and all that kind of stuff. So there's a cool like outdoor element to that, especially at that age, you know, between like 2 and 10. When I was 10, we moved from there to Elk Grove, California, which is just south of Sacramento, and into a very new, very cookie cutter suburb called Laguna Creek, which was brand new at the time. It's best known at this point, probably not very known, but it's where most of the, if you buy like an Apple computer or something,
okay,
it's probably going to come from Laguna Creek. It's like one of their big shipping facilities on the West Coast. Anyway, my folks still live there, but that was like the formative years. And there was something about that kind of the culture of that sort of suburb, you know, predominantly white suburb thing that cultivated some version of punk rock angst in us when we were young. And so,
right,
you know, skateboarding and punk and hardcore and metal and all those subcultures and countercultures and things like that were very appealing to us because we didn't really feel like we fit in with the jocks and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, with your dad being a pastor, obviously, you know, religion's a big part of your early life. It still is.
Sure.
You know, and you guys have been always quoted as like not really the fence sitting type of Christian band. You know, not a band that's all of a sudden going to start making secular music. You guys have always said, you know, we are a Christian band. This is just what we are, what we do, and our fans appreciate it. So with your dad being a pastor when you're a kid and you're getting into like metal and hardcore and punk rock and skateboarding, were your parents supportive of that kind of thing? How did kind of religion play in? Because I'm sure a lot of the stuff you were listening to was, you know, very not Christian.
Sure. I mean, it kind of went a little bit both ways. Like they were certainly supportive of my brother and I doing artistic endeavors, whether that was, you know, visual arts or music and things like that. And my dad was a guitar player. My mom sang. That's kind of where I learned how to, you know, find a harmony, you know, within a melody and things like that. And so there was that stuff kind of came from them. The particular styles of music. Yeah. I mean, to them, they would rather it be like a Christian album or something like that. But there wasn't a lot of pushback with that sort of thing. Like, as long as we were good kids and like didn't find ourselves in like a ton of trouble and that sort of thing, I don't think they were particularly too concerned. And these days, they're, you know, as cool as can be about it. They fully understand, you know. But yeah, you know, there were times where I would, if I wanted to wear a Metallica shirt to school, I would have to change into it when I got there, you know, or like, or things like that. And that was definitely a thing, or like, you know, hide my Slayer CDs like underneath my bed or whatever. So that was definitely a thing, but I mean, it wasn't super heavy handed. I had, you know, some, extended family that were a little bit more on the hardcore fundamentalist edge, whose parents, you know, were definitely more strict than mine. But mine, as far as that thing goes, were actually pretty cool. So, you know, like I said, these days they're just like ecstatic about the band and the success and like everything.
Absolutely. No, I always thought that the dark imagery in Demon Hunter was kind of interesting, you know, as a Christian band to have that, like, you know, almost like something that you would see maybe a black metal band do, you know, sure, what I mean, in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was a conscious thing on your part or what, you know, from day one you guys have had this aesthetic.
Yeah.
And obviously that's due to you and your brother's visual art background.
Sure. I mean, if there's going to be something that is, you know, overtly dark looking, I think it's always with some sort of purpose. Like there's always a deliberate element to it, you know? And on the flip side of that, I have always, you know, though I appreciate being able to resonate with like-minded people I also, a major component of what I like to do through the lyrics and songs and through the band in general is to kind of poke and prod a little bit, especially, like I said, at the, you know, more of the fundamental legalistic types of Christianity. Those, the people that I would say kind of live in a bubble, it's always been a kind of part of my agenda to kind of like poke and prod at those people and maybe get them to like wake up or be jarred by something. And so I don't necessarily, in terms of that world, the Christian world, I try not to play it too safe, in terms of the kinds, right. the kinds of references that I make or the kinds of analogies that I make through lyrics or the types of imagery that we do, or that, you know, collaborations with certain bands or who we tour with and things like that, what, where we play, you know, they're all variety of fundamental people that would have a problem with every single thing from whether or not you play churches or clubs or, you know, what color the lighting is in the photos that your band took, which is a serious, which is a serious thing that someone's actually asked me. So like it goes,
that's
it
incredible.
Goes as deep as it possible, as you could possibly imagine. And you know, part of my, what I like to do is to kind of chip away at like the ridiculousness of that type of thinking. And so I see there being purpose on kind of both sides of that.
Yeah.
And so the dark imagery, you know, I like things that are metal to be metal. I like there to be like something, I wouldn't say stereotypical, but I think there's just, an inherency to what type of, imagery or what type of vibe that music like this kind of conjures up. And I'm okay with finding a lane in that,
right.
where that works for us, you know. Even if you were to take like biblical theology or Christianity, there's a lot of dark stuff in there. So there's a ton of imagery or analogy that is ripe for the picking, in terms of that stuff. I mean, a lot of non-Christian heavy metal bands are pulling biblical imagery, you know what I mean?
Right.
To make their stuff sound like dark and whatever. So, you know, I can pull the same sorts of things and just take a different spin on it. With the logo, you know, it's essentially just a literal interpretation of the name. It's a demon with a bullet hole in its head. And so that allows us to do all kinds of different things, with that logo, which we've done on every album cover and, you know,
right,
a million
exactly.
different ways
and
on
that's
merch.
The thing, right? Is like the new stuff that you have here, you know, on Spotify, Close Enough, you know, which is a new single, you know, the, it's a skull.
Yeah,
there's a skull on an album cover, which has been done thousands and thousands of times on every metal record ever.
Right.
You know, but it's like you don't need to put, you know, the whole round peg in a square hole or whatever the you know, the analogy is. Why would you do that at this point? Right. It's like,
sure.
It's trying to make this work in a new, unique way, which you guys seem to do every single time. And make it cool, and there's a challenge there.
Yeah, I mean it's great because it's a challenge because there is a box, there's a sandbox that we need to stay in. At least that yeah. I've, you know, kind of a self-imposed sandbox. And the challenge is that, you know, it has to be our logo. It has to be done in some way that hasn't been done before, and the freedom is that I don't have to think of some completely new concept for an album cover every time. And there's freedom in that. There's freedom in not having, there's freedom in the boundaries to, you know, to a certain degree is, I know what it needs to be. So there's like there is some sense of definitive direction.
Right.
And then the details are the things that we get to kind of play with or wonder about or explore. So the way that the skull is presented, whether it's like some kind of fine art, you know, pen and ink or a painting, or whether in the cases of the new records, it's a digital rendering. I had someone do a digital sculpt and then we rendered it and lit it all in the computer, and it looks very real. But you know, it was the first time that we've actually done something like that. And so there's a million different variations on that logo that we could do. And so that's kind of what keeps it exciting, is like, you know, it's going to be the logo, but you don't know how that logo is going to be represented.
Right. I mean, you guys, you know, with the company that you're running now with your brother, you know, and all the incredible things, you know, that you've done with, you know, I mean, from the Grammys to Whole Foods to NASA, you know what I mean? You've worked with all this stuff, and you're always on, you know, the cutting edge of whatever new design stuff is out there. I mean, that must be cool to use some of that stuff that you learn from working, you know, your 9-to-5 jobs doing that, and then being like, hey, how can we apply this to the Demon Hunter logo in a new way?
Sure.
Like, obviously, like, as you go on and you're talking about album 9 and 10, maybe there's, like, some people would have a bit of a creative block. Okay, what can we do we haven't done? But with you guys, does it get almost easier because you kind of have learned so much about, you know, the game?
You know, I would put, honestly, it's a kind of a weird, when I'm doing the artwork for my own band, you know, usually the cover is something that I source out to someone else. And then
really?
The rest, yeah, yeah. So the album covers, with the exception of Storm the Gates of Hell, which was our fourth record, and then Extremist, the two covers that were with that one. Mm-hmm. Someone else had done every other one. So we've had everyone from like Dan Seagrave, who's like a death metal fine artist, incredible painter, to Justin Kammerer, who's done a lot of like hardcore and punk and metal stuff, pen and ink stuff, do True Defiance. I haven't, you know, I like to play art director more than I like to play designer on my own stuff.
Right.
And it gives me an opportunity to do that, which is fun. But then when it comes to, you know, kind of fleshing out the remaining package, for me, it's more about, with my own band, I'm very particular about, like, the presentation in terms of, like, the clarity of it. I think there's almost a brand style guide sort of thing that I'd like to follow with the way that Demon Hunter stuff is presented. It's very nuanced, and you know, some people might not even realize it, but, like, you know, I like to present lyrics in columns as opposed to, like, you know, strung out in chunks, and there's sort of a color palette that I like playing within, which is somewhere in the black, white, red, and then maybe tones of metallics and things like that.
Right.
So there's kind of things that I like to go back to that are kind of tried and true. And to me, playing with Demon Hunter stuff on like an album packaging level is more about brand consistency. And that's definitely, like you were saying, something I've learned through my design career, is the importance of, you know, the branding or the visual identity of an entity, whether that's a business, you know, or a band or an artist or something. So when I'm doing artwork for other bands, it's almost like my excuse to do something artistic, or to try to pull off something, you know, out of the box, or, you know, maybe it's to balance out the music with something that doesn't feel like it works, and then all of a sudden becomes kind of part of the puzzle. Like with August Burns Red, they don't like to do heavy metal looking stuff.
And right.
The goal there is always to do something that looks more artistic than a typical heavy metal thing. And then before you know it, it becomes part of their brand, and that's what you're kind of expecting to do. So there's something cool about doing that for other bands. But then when it comes to my band, there's something about the consistency. I call it like a micro reinvention every time, because like we are kind of reinventing like the way that we present that skull each time, but then everything else surrounding it kind of feels natural. It feels like you've seen it before almost. So it's like I said, it's nuanced and kind of nerdy, but there's something about the doing my own stuff that's a little bit different. I don't take very many risks, I'll say that. In terms of design,
that's fair. Yeah,
in terms
sure.
of design wise, I don't, you know, with other people's stuff, I'll like flip lyrics upside down and put them in a circle and like put die cut holes right through the center of lyrics and stuff like that. Like, see what I can get away with, you know? I would never do that kind of stuff for Demon Hunter. Like, I'll just say that.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, MerchTable.com, and we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Well, maybe that's a good segue into, you know, Asterix. And, you know, a lot of people that, you know, were around at that time buying CDs, you know, at Best Buy and everything, you guys were behind pretty much, I mean, I feel like just every record that had good artwork was Asterix.
There were a lot,
and you,
yeah.
You guys had a certain look. You know, and I just remember, you know, some of the ones I remember, and I didn't even look it up. I just remember like the Armor for Sleep artwork, which was really, really cool for What to Do When You're Dead. The Norma Jean, Oh God, the Aftermath album, which was incredible, which I believe you won a Grammy for.
Nominated.
And then Dead Poetic was another New Medicines. It was one of my favorite albums. Still to this day, a great album.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know you guys are behind that and Bleeding Through and all these different artists. And, like, you know, I don't know what it was, but you guys knew that everybody else didn't know. But you really were a cutting edge design, you know, designer, you and your brother and everything you were doing. And, I mean, the amount of things you must have turned down. It must have been incredible at that point, just with everybody coming to you guys.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we said yes to a lot, which is why it seemed like the record store was flooded with our stuff. I mean, we were, you know, at that time we were in our 20s. You know, we didn't have any kids. The world was kind of our oyster, and so we were working. Again, you know, going back to the touring frequency of the band, it's like, you know, we were designing 14, 16 hours a day, sometimes weekends, like for months and years. I mean, you hear about people putting in their 10,000 hours. It's like, I just like sneer at that. Cause I put in like twice that, you know, just in those first like 15 years. And so, yeah, we didn't say no to a ton. We said yes a lot, even when we barely had time for it. But yeah, like in terms of where we were kind of pulling inspiration and things like that, you know, we were just into, I think the reason why we were able to kind of present something that felt fresh for the scene or for the scenes that we were dealing with was because we were kind of pulling from outside of that. You know, there's something that's kind of, feels synonymous with every sort of scene, whether it's hip hop or metal or punk or emo or whatever. And when all that they do is just kind of pull from somewhere else and introduce it, as long as it's done in a way that's like interesting and well executed and high quality, and the concept is really, that's a really like well executed concept. Mm-hmm. It's always a good idea, and it's always going to be met with like, oh, you know, that's cool. That's refreshing. That's great. That's, you know, I haven't seen something like that before. So we're looking at guys like Storm Thorgerson, especially the guy who did all the Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin stuff and the Mars Volta and all that kind of stuff. He was kind of the, to put it simply, he was the king of guy photographed in a weird environment, doing something weird. Do you know what I mean? Like,
the, yeah,
and so many of our albums kind of were that. It was like, oh, there's a guy like flying through a neighborhood, or there's a guy whose skin is peeling off, or whatever.
Right.
Storm Thorgerson was the catalyst for most of that kind of stuff. Like, he was doing the kind of surrealist photography stuff back in the 60s and 70s. And so we were looking to guys like him. We were looking to guys like Von Oliver, who did all the 4AD stuff, you know, Pixies, Breeders, mm-hmm. for, especially for typography. He was kind of the master of odd typography. He would even print stuff out, cut it out, curl it, put it on, you know, clothespins, hang it, photograph it, and then that would become the type treatment. Do you know what I mean? Like, he would go right. above and beyond to do these really elaborate
exactly.
type treatments.
Well, that's what it was. I mean, it was you guys going above and beyond with everything. I think it's, is it the Bleeding Through album cover that you did that has like an actual like pig's heart or something?
Yeah, so the Bleeding Through the Truth was basically, you know, band members whose limbs or faces or whatever have been kind of like blown off, and there's just like a ungodly amount of what you would assume would be blood. There are black and white photos everywhere, and so the way that we did that was just by, you know, that's just all in the preparation of the photo shoot. If you take the time to do the preparation correctly and give yourself less work in post, it's just going to look more real every time. So that was, you know, part of a kind of a new level for us of trying to do things that were very interrupted by textures and things like that. What we did a lot right. early on were highly textured photorealistic images, and the texturing essentially, you know, it was a trendy thing to do, but it also allowed you to kind of like hide a lot of the inconsistencies in the Photoshop yeah. work and things like that. And so as that started to become more of like a thing that people were doing, and it kind of got tired and it got a little bit old, we kind of switched gears to doing things that weren't textured at all and just work extra hard on making them look really real. So part of that Bleeding Through thing was take the people, you know, kind of sketch them out in whatever angle we wanted them shot at. And then we essentially had styrofoam that mimicked the positioning of their body. And
wow.
we had the, you know, pig entrails, a bunch of other kind of random gross meat products.
Where did you get that stuff?
From a butcher shop? Our photographer, yeah, at the time, his name was Jeff Gross. He was one of those guys kind of...
yeah, Jeff Gross is right.
Yeah. he'd done a ton of our stuff at the time. He was kind of our go-to guy at the time. Him and Dave Hill, who ended up being a massive photographer. But those two guys, basically, you could give them a concept and kind of tell them what you were looking for, and then they were kind of their own producers. They would just go out and make it happen. So you could ask for something ridiculous, like the band's going to come over and you need to convince them to completely douse themselves in chocolate sauce, which is what that blood was.
Right.
And he was great at that kind of thing, because he was a, you know, a photographer, definitely at heart, the kind of guy that would go up and ask someone, you know, he's the kind of person that could go up and ask homeless people if he could take their photos, like, which isn't something that like a lot of people could do. So he had a sense of, you know, he was very sure of himself in that way. So he was
right,
great,
right.
a great guy to have working for us in that regard, because we could pitch him anything and he would just make it happen.
Wow.
So that thing is, wow. he went and got the styrofoam, he cut it out according to our sketches, and then kind of pinned, or I think he pinned a lot of this meat and gunk to it. And then he covered that in black. I think it was corn syrup mixed with chocolate sauce. And then photographed the band with the same, you know, like half of their body covered in this mixture. And then what ended up being like two photos, the post work was really, really simple because everything lined up in terms of the angles and things like that. It was, and there was a lot of black to kind of hide certain things in. And so, yeah, it ended up being a really, really cool looking thing because it just looks so real.
Yeah.
But, that was mainly because we just kind of did all the work like on the front end, making sure that the angles and all that stuff was correct.
What's some of your favorite projects you worked on back then? You know, in that kind of in the heyday of whatever the scene.
Yeah. Well, Norma Jean was definitely one for me. So my brother did the Bleeding Through artwork. Norma Jean was mine. And that was a huge labor of love. That one's a little bit unassuming from the album cover because the cover is just kind of a type treatment. And then you open it up and you get these really kind of like wacky looking, surrealistic images of people's bodies, you know, either conjoined at the waist or, you know, they have vines growing out of their stomach or they have glass growing out of their back or whatever. And so again, the idea there was like less is more in terms of like the background. So the background's just kind of this light blue. It's almost supposed to feel like a gallery, like an installation or something.
Right.
Which it almost makes it even weirder or creepier. And, so that was, again, a lot of, we shot a lot of kind of, friends like in certain positions that would be easier for us to kind of manipulate. And we sent those to the photographer, did the same sort of thing as we did with Bleeding Through, had him shoot, you know, whether it was glass or vines or whatever, and like exactly where we needed him to be.
Right.
It was a ton of Photoshop work because you still have to fake a lot of the shadows and you have to fake a lot of the, you know, if something's growing out of someone's body, you got to find a way to make it look like it's coming out of there. so there was that. And then that artwork actually was a ton of time spent on typography because the lyrics were essentially typed out, printed out, a lot of the lines were crossed out, either by like a typewriter X kind of scenario or like with red lines, like edited. And so I had to have the foresight to, you know, if I'm going to double a line or double a word, I need to know that I'm going to cross it out later. And so I would, I would take the song and kind of like multiply certain elements of it and stuff with the idea that eventually I'd be going over it and editing it. And
so, had you already heard the music when you did that artwork?
I think so. Although the idea of that became less and less necessary, like as we had gone on. Working at the label, because I was in house at Solid State and Tooth and Nail at that time, so I would hear everything if I wanted to. But if there was a project that was, you know, from a different label, a lot of the times because of the big fear of leaking back in those days, a lot of the times we just wouldn't get to hear anything. And as long as we kind of knew like what genre the band kind of fit into, we were fine. But honestly, that didn't even matter to us because we were just, all we really wanted to do was make art that was, you know, thought provoking or interesting or, you know, maybe jarring. That's really all that we wanted to do. And even if it didn't necessarily fit into the genre, to us, that was almost a good thing. Because we didn't love what was happening in that or in the world of, you know, screamo art. You know, we were trying to turn the tables on all that stuff. We were trying to make it basically turn all that type of stuff into more of a high art.
Yeah. Well, you did.
Yeah. And that's what
which is why we're talking about it, you know, whatever, 12 years later, you know, I mean, it was really amazing and special what you guys were doing that there was no other in-house. I mean, all those labels had in-house people, you know, and a lot of them were very talented, great people, but they weren't even scratching the surface of what you guys were doing. I mean, maybe it was based a lot on just the budgets or the other labels, you know, not even allowing for that. It's like, we need the artwork yesterday. This record needs to, you know, get pressed. Whereas it seems like Tooth and Nail gave you guys a lot more rope, you know?
That's absolutely true. Yeah. I was going to say there, you know, we would always strive to do something artistic and interesting, and we would always try to push for that, even if it meant that we were doing something that was very standard in terms of packaging, things like that. But
right.
we did get a lot of freedom, especially in the early aughts. Like, I would say between, you know, I think I started in 01 in the art department, but especially between 01 and like 08, we had, I mean, if we came up with some wacky concept, like we want a blue tinted jewel case with a die cut through the whole booklet and a fifth metallic color. I mean, there's like a decent chance that we would get like a yes, which is, you know, after the digital, you know, smackdown, so to speak, where no label was, you know, interested in doing anything larger than a 12 page book, no fifth colors, no special yep. inks or anything, you know, yep. It was kind of, it became more increasingly rare to find labels that were interested in doing things that kind of cost for physical packaging. The longer that we went, and there was only a couple of them that, you know, Rhymesayers, who have, you know, Atmosphere and Greaves and stuff like that. Is one of those labels that somehow after all that stuff went down would always be like, let's make it special. Let's make it crazy. And so it was always really cool to work with them because it was almost like 2005 again.
know? right, of course.
But there are very few labels that were interested in doing that kind of stuff. And now it's starting to almost kind of pendulum swing back in the other direction, mainly because vinyl.
Exactly.
Vinyl's something again, and people have really kind of, it's come around to the point where it's popular enough where almost every release is seeing a vinyl release. And then like some sort of special edition or deluxe edition thing is usually kind of on the table, especially for the larger artists. So that kind of stuff is really fun. You know, we're obviously pressing fewer units. But I think that there's ways to, when we were at Tooth and Nail, there was always the part of the excitement about coming up with something that felt like it wouldn't be possible was figuring out how to make it possible. And so there was at some point the discussion about, you know, I want to do a screen print on the jewel case itself so that there's like a layer of art on the jewel case and then a layer of art on the booklet behind it. And what we found out pretty quickly was that screen printing on the jewel case was not something that would be feasible for us from a, you know, production standpoint, whether I don't remember right. if it was a cost thing or not, but our, you know, my immediate thought after that was, well, I wonder if we could do a full size clear sticker on the front of the jewel case.
Like Dead Poetic
or He Is Legend or Trenches. There's a ton that we did. And that was basically us just like finding a loophole or a way around doing printing on the jewel case itself.
It's right.
Like, I wonder if we could do that. And, you know, there were always small inconsistencies with that. Like sometimes the sticker would not be perfectly straight, especially sure. if it was like something that interacted with what was behind it. You know, you had to kind of build that in.
Build it in design. You know, it's kind of sad though that so many records back then didn't come out on vinyl. You know what True. I mean? You're looking at this tiny little CD. I mean, it would have been awesome to have it on 12 inch, you know, 12 by 12 vinyl. Cover. Has there been stuff that's been reissued that you've been a part of? Of that stuff? Like you've dug out the old files and had to reformat it for the new format?
Yep. Quite a bit, actually. I don't know how much I can say because honestly, I don't pay attention enough to know what they've announced in that regard. But I know Tooth and Nail has been going back and kind of reissuing a lot of those classic, like I said, kind of the 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Some of the bigger releases from that era. And I have been working on quite a few of those in the last year or two.
That must be fun to go back and kind of reminisce a little bit. I mean, do you enjoy that?
Yeah, it's cool. I like the bigger format. You know, I like to kind of rethink a few things that like I may do a little bit differently this time without really kind of jeopardizing the original look of the art. Like I don't want to tweak it so much that it's, you know, the nostalgia goes away, but you know, I can make subtle different, you know, choices that kind of appease my anal eye. The one thing that I am missing is there is a, with the jewel case in particular, especially with packages like Dead Poetic, you had that kind of plastic front.
Yeah.
And that, like, you know, despite how awesome it is to see, start seeing things on vinyl and the resurgence and repressing and reissuing, there's still like a limitations in there, you know.
Yeah,
I wish absolutely for something like that.
There was something three dimensional about a CD case. I mean, at least the Jewel case, the way that you guys designed it, at least, which made it really cool. You know, able to use even the spine, you know, adding that into the artwork,
right?
You know, and that's something with a vinyl. Like, sure, it's bigger and it's beautiful, but it's also flat,
right? And if you want to try and almost mimic what you did on the CD, it's like the cost is just going to skyrocket, you know, because it's four times the size. And,
yeah. Absolutely, man. Well, I want to get back to talking about a little bit about music, and I love the artwork talk, but I'm sure a lot of people want to hear about, you know, some of the stuff going on behind the new Demon Hunter record. Mm-hmm. Records. I'm sorry,
that's
War and Peace out March 1st. Talk to me about these records. Why are you doing two of them? Now,
well, it's been kind of on our radar to do two records, probably for like the last maybe four records. It was something that was kind of on the table, I want to say, in 2012, before we were about to do our sixth. Let's see. Yeah, I think it was our sixth record, sixth or seventh. And it's something that I've always thought about. I mean, we have these kind of two polarized styles that happen on every record, and it's everything from, like, you know, barn burner like thrash song to like down tempo, you know, what we kind of refer to as a ballad,
right?
And then everything in between, you know, there's songs that are all heavy, all screaming, there's songs that are all heavy, all singing, and then, you know, every variation therein. And so we kind of had this opportunity to, you know, play with pulling those polarized styles apart and kind of experimenting within those realms on like a record autonomously. So it'd be every record I do, basically, it's like, okay, it needs to have this many songs that sound like this. It needs to have at least a couple of quote unquote ballads. It needs to have like one full on, like, you know, blazing barn burner, at least. It needs to have at least one song that's all screaming, you know, things like that go through my head. And so there is like some version of like a formula of like track listing formula. And I try to make it interesting within that formula. With these, the idea with these records was always, what if we were to, you know, parse out those two styles and like kind of pull them apart and say, okay, what if we did an album that was just entirely melodic and that had no screaming on it? Or that's not a hard and fast rule, but what if it was something that just didn't rely on that whatsoever? And then what if we did an album where we weren't worried about making sure that there were some slower, more ballad songs? And so it was basically kind of an experiment in that. Part of it was just to see if we could pull it off. You know, part of it was because we love to write and record. It's our favorite part of being in a band. And so, you know, usually, you know, especially with the ballads, since there's only a few of those per record, it's like there's almost so much experimentation that can really happen within the style of those types of songs.
Of course, sure.
If you go too far left, all of a sudden it's going to be like, what on earth is that? But if you do a whole album of melodic songs, you can go that far left, and then it just becomes less of a distance, right, stylistically.
Right.
So it basically allowed us to do things that maybe were a little bit left of what we were doing in both regards. And I don't know, it just felt like the right time. We had finished our eighth album, and so it was like, why not round out 9 and 10 at the same time? It was kind of a good time to do that. It felt like it was the right time in our career to do something like this. I think doing an endeavor like this too early in your career could kind of seem silly.
I agree.
And self-indulgent. And also, I didn't want to do a double album because those, to me, are exhausting. and so I know it might as well be the same thing as a double album, but to me, it's like, it's a little more satisfying that hopefully each one could kind of be digested individually.
Yeah, I get that. Exactly. You know, and the old, you know, whatever it is, you know, everyone said this forever since, you know, the beginning of music. Like, no band has ever pulled off a perfect double album.
No.
I mean, the Beatles couldn't even do it, you know. Totally. And so many times, you know, whether it's, you know, Smashing Pumpkins or, you know, all these other bands that have made really good double albums that are classic double albums. It's like, man, if you just took those 28 songs and just took the best 12, you'd have like an incredible record.
Of course. I mean, we only remember 12 songs from Melancholy anyway, right?
Exactly, right? And if it was just those 12, think about that album. It would be, you know. So I always like had this idea in my head. It was like, okay, do a double album, be fully prepared to put out a double album,
and then once it's actually done, just
cut it in half.
Yeah,
and take the best shit, and then maybe that's the secret to making the, you know, a classic album.
I'm sure it is. Yeah, just self-editing.
But I like the concept though of having one kind of crazy, you know, I like the term barn burner. That's a term I use as well. You know, and having that, and then an album of ballads, and I think that's going to be something that's going to really, you know, your fan base is going to really like as well.
I think that's
a really cool idea.
There's always been a little bit of a debate on like what styles that we do are the ones that resonate most with people, if you just take it by, you know, looking at Spotify stats or iTunes stats things like that.
Like, I mean, I Am a Stone. I mean, that's your biggest song on Spotify,
and that's like definitely our most melodic a piece thing we've song. Ever done. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a B-side. Yeah. And, but then you go play live and it's like people are yelling out for like the heaviest stuff that we've ever written. So,
right.
You know, I think what it is really is that people like both, you know, but there's like, it's more often the right time to play something that is more melodic than it is to play something that is really aggressive. So I think that's just the nature of it. But I mean, part of it is just this experiment of like, what is going to resonate more with people? What are they going to find interesting? And it just kind of helps us keep fresh in terms of what we're doing with the blueprint at this point. You know, it's been so long and the changes have been subtle over the years, but you know, we're in this zone right now where, my guitar player Patrick and I are kind of writing things together at this point, which is a fairly new thing just as of the last record Outlive. And so there's a freshness to that, which is nice. I mean, that's another reason why this was even possible. If, you know, I was responsible for writing all the songs the way that I did for, you know, The World is a Thorn, True Defiance, Extremist, I don't think that I would have been able to do this many songs, especially juggling the things that I do. And so
it's a lot of songs.
It's been awesome to have someone sending me songs and just be like, oh, that's the one. All I need to do is write melodies and lyrics for it. That's great. Make a couple tweaks to the, you know, if any, to the structure. And it's just, it takes a lot of the load off of me, which is awesome. And it makes it more exciting again. It makes like less pressure for me. And I still like to write, you know, songs. And so there's about half of the songs are mine, but it's really nice not to have to have such a hold on the songwriting in terms of every element, you know.
Totally, absolutely. Well, the new records are out March 1st. You can get some pre-orders at the Demon Hunter website, including one that comes with an 80-page book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously artwork and art direction isn't very important for your band, which is why a majority of this conversation was about that. But you know what? One thing I thought was actually pretty cool was actually how cheap it is that you can actually get it for like only like $50, which these days seems like a steal.
Yeah. I mean, that's always been something that is important to us. If we're going to do something that's deluxe or that's special, we want it to be affordable. And, you know, last record we did a pledge thing where we did a deluxe. I think it was $40, but then we did, just for fun, we did a super deluxe, which was $500. And there was only five of those.
How many were there?
There were five, but they sold in the first day.
Right.
But
you
know, the first thing, it was a wooden box that was etched, you know, this big 12-inch wooden box. And you open up the top and the first thing you see is just like a flush top with a little slide with my blood in it, on each one of them.
Whoa.
So yeah, it was the most, we were like, what's the most intense deluxe edition that we could ever conjure? So that one was insane. But yeah, for the most part, I like to do something that's like, you know, pretty affordable. A lot of our deluxe editions come with like some sort of DVD, like making of thing. This record that was like with this amount of music and this amount of lyrics and things like that, doing like a component like that just felt like a little bit too much. Again, I don't want to exhaust people. So it's just the music, but you do get a B-side on each record just from the deluxe edition.
I got to cut you off. Yeah. Where did the blood come from? How did you do that?
Oh, from my thumb. So I had like a diabetes needle that I used. That was pretty easy.
Now, what if, I guess, you know, those five people that have your blood now in case they want to frame you,
yeah, exactly.
You know, for some crazy crime or something.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that.
That's wow. That's incredible, man. Damn, dude. Well, everybody check out that stuff. That's really cool. It sounds like a really, really, really cool record. Before I let you go, I got a couple fan questions,
sure.
If you don't mind. Somebody asks, how did the Five Finger Death Punch collaboration come about, and how was doing that?
That was fun. So
seems a bit random.
It's a little random, although those guys are big fans. When they were starting their band, we were a big kind of reference point for them, according to Chris, the bass player, and Zoltan. They've always been fans. They've reached out to us a couple times. Like when we're in Vegas, we'll go hang out with Chris Kahalo and stuff like that. They're just really nice guys. And so I think just, you know, in terms of us being a bit of an inspiration, they just kind of reached out and asked if we would do a guest spot.
Yeah.
And so I did that when I was visiting Nashville. That was perfect because Jeremiah, who our guitar player, is the one who has the home studio where we do pretty much everything. And so I did that there with him. We sent that back, and I think I don't know what their plan really was with that record, but they had a bunch of guest spots, and a lot of those songs ended up being the non-guest spot version on the actual record. And then they released like a special edition that had some of the alternate versions that had the guests. And then there was like a video game version, which was the one that I was on. So it didn't end up, mine didn't end up on the actual record. I don't know exactly the thinking behind that, but it made its way out in some form, but not.
Well, people seem to know about it if it's a question.
Yeah, so. They definitely, it's been out there, but it's not the easiest thing to find. We've had a lot of people asking us like where they can find it and stuff like that. But yeah, I've done so many guest spots over the years.
I think I saw a pretty exhaustive list on on like Wikipedia or something.
Yeah, for like post-punk bands or screamo bands or whatever, like I would just, by virtue of working with Aaron Sprinkle, who did so much of the stuff at that time, I was like the resident like screaming guy.
Did Aaron work on your new record at all?
He didn't. Records? Actually, this is the first, these two records are the first ones that he had not worked on in any capacity. And the last record, he just kind of helped produce the vocals. So it's been a little bit, more of us taking our own reins in that regard. But also, like, every time I approach a song, I'm doing it with, like, my Aaron Sprinkle cap on. So, you know, he's like my sensei. So, yeah, but when he would be doing like Amber Lynn or something like that, and he was like, we need a screamer, like, you know, I would come in and do like stuff on those types of records. So it was just kind of like, you know, a lot of it was out of necessity. And then, a lot were just friends that we would tour with, bands that we tour with.
Absolutely. I mean, with you doing so much, with you doing so little amount of touring, do you find it's like, oh my God, I haven't screamed in a while?
Oh yeah.
Like, is it kind of like hard sometimes to get back in the groove of screaming and not like losing your voice? And like, you know, because people always ask me, oh, how do you do it night in, night out? I'm like, well, it's kind of like a muscle, you know? If I haven't done it in a while, it's harder. So find that to be the case?
For sure. It's scary too, because, there have been times where I'm like, oh man, I don't, you know. Well, the good thing is, I will say, when we do these fly-out festivals, I can just blow my voice out. because I don't have to sing the next day.
One show, yeah, right? Right.
But when we're playing a few in a row, it is a little scary because I'm like, I don't know. I don't remember how this, you know, how I'm supposed to do this. But what I'll do usually is rehearse in my car, like on long drives before like a tour, you know, if there's a little string of shows. Usually I need to do that just to kind of brush up on the lyrics anyway, but it's a nice excuse to be able to belt it without anyone looking.
That's what I tell people too. I always say, I used to practice screaming in my car. That was my trial and error. Yep. That way, you know, no matter how stupid you sound, you know, no one's listening from, you know, the basement or the apartment next door or whatever, exactly. You know? So that's funny. Okay. Well, last fan question, and this is kind of an interesting story here. It goes back to, I guess Metallica asking the U.S. military to stop using their music for interrogations. And you guys were allegedly sent your CDs and patches to the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the quote here is, this is from the soldier who claimed to have killed bin Laden, saying that this happened. And he quote, "I wore my Demon Hunter patch on every mission. I wore it when I blasted bin Laden."
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Which is intense. And I guess just looking for your take on that.
Yeah, so that was actually an Esquire quote.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that magazine came out while we were on tour with In Flames. And so there's a lot there. I could talk about this for a half a day or whatever. And there was a long time where we weren't really like fielding questions about this because it was so, was such a volatile nature to it that, you know, we waited a couple of days. We let the smoke settle a little bit. We issued a press release about it, clearing some of the air around some of the lingo, some of the language and the specifics about what was said, which was very much made it sound like Metallica was like, stop using our music. And Demon Hunter was like, you can use ours instead. And that wasn't really the case. The case was, we've always sent stuff to the military. We've always had a huge military following. We have a song on the triptych called The Soldier Song, and that was 2004 or whatever, five. So we've always had, there's always been something about Demon Hunter that's resonated with the armed forces. And so we get a ton of correspondence from them. And so we've always sent them care packages. We've always sent records. There are whole entire platoons called Demon Hunters, and they, you know, they make their own patches on base there, and it'll be the Demon Hunter skull, and they'll wear them on their get-ups. And, you know, we get asked probably monthly from a platoon if they can use our logo for something. We're like,
crazy.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Just don't, you know, you can't sell it, but if you want to make shirts or whatever that say Demon Hunter, that's cool. And so we've always done that sort of thing. There's always been a lot of that going on. At one point, we received a photo of a platoon of guys that was like, it was a small platoon of guys that were probably six or seven guys with huge beards. They're all wearing glasses. They're very much like special ops guys.
Yeah.
I'm pretty positive that it was SEAL Team 6, but the guy who shot bin Laden was one of the guys in the photos. And they're all wearing Demon Hunter patches. And that wasn't like, that wasn't kind of uncommon for those types of teams, like special agents and stuff. And so anyway, we're in the snow, driving to some, small town in New Mexico on tour with In Flames in February of 2012. And we get a call that Esquire article's out and that people are flipping out about it because of a lot of the connotations that are made. So, you know, we have CNN wanting to do interviews. We have all kinds of very legitimate news outlets calling us that want us to, you know, comment on it. And it was just not, you know, at that time we were like, let's just chill out here. I don't think we need to like really have this be the thing that we're known for right now. Like, that's not really something that's of interest to us, is to like,
yeah,
capitalize on this or whatever. We've always been appreciative of the armed forces for the support and stuff like that. But you know, there was the way that some of the things were worded were a little bit like, oh, so you guys are cool with torture? And it's like, yeah, well, that's not what that's not what, what this is at all. So,
right.
Anyway, it was a little bit interesting, but you know, I'm still stoked that dude was wearing a Demon Hunter patch. He's got two Demon Hunter tattoos, actually.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, and so yeah, it's very very interesting. But we like to joke that that Demon Hunter killed Bin Laden a lot.
Jeez. Well, that's a crazy story, and you know, I mean that's kind of a cool thing, you know. I guess that you guys just sort of, you know, were like, hey, check this out, and somewhere along the way, you know, it got passed around, and it does make sense, you know. I guess for people going on those missions,
yeah,
you know,
something kind of Demon synonymous. Hunter.
There's something about it that sort of works, you know.
Right.
And of course, your shit always looks cool, so.
Yeah, there's like an analogous thing with the name and things like that work, but then there's also like, you know, when you dive into the lyrics, they're like very helpful, and you know, there's a lot of that. So I think that's a big kind of a big factor for those guys over there, is like they like that's not just like negativity through and through.
Yeah, they probably deal with enough negativity,
exactly.
You know, and with what they do. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for taking the time. Anything else to tell the people before I let you go?
No, just thanks for all the awesome feedback on the new songs. I'm just excited for everyone to hear the full albums, and so we can't come.
Are people
going
to be able to see you guys live? You got some stuff planned?
Yeah, we definitely will be out this year. We don't have anything on the books this second, but it's definitely on our radar, and yeah, we'll be out there for sure.
All right, man. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, appreciate it, man.
Yeah, take care, man.
See ya.
So there it is with Ryan. I want to thank him so much for doing this, taking the time out of his very, very busy schedule. And wow, eye-opening stuff. I loved every minute of this episode. I know we really got into the design stuff, but man, just so cool, everything that he's done. And make sure you go give those Demon Hunter records, multiple records that are out now, a spin, War and Peace. They're both really, really cool. I'm going to leave you with a tune. This one jumped out at me. I think it's a banger. Here it is, Unbound on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. We'll see you next week.